You never know where you might end up finding yourself in life. Jonah was the son of Amittai, a beloved child of God, and he was called by God to be a prophet to the city of Nineveh, a city known at that time as a flashpoint of violence, even terrorism, in the region, especially against nations like Israel. Jonah was called to preach against the wickedness of the people there and to call them to turn away, to do a 180 away from the violence, the terror, their wicked ways, and to return to their Creator. And Jonah answered the call by doing a 180 of his own and heading off to a place called Anywhere But Nineveh. And his descent began. From the hills, he sprinted down to the town of Joppa. Once in Joppa, he got passage for a boat headed to Tarshish, and he stepped down into the boat. And once he was on board, he stepped further down into the sleeping cabin below to catch 40 winks. And it was at this moment that suddenly a violent storm overtook them, and the sailors ended up calling out to any god they could think of or invent to help them. And it was their cries that awakened Jonah as they urged him to do the same, to call out to his god. A knot began to form in Jonah's stomach, and he eventually fessed up to why he was on that boat and why he was fleeing to Tarshish. And then he urged the sailors to throw him overboard in order to save themselves and to save their ship. And so the sailors throw up a prayer to Jonah's God, "God, forgive us, we don't know what we're doing." And they throw him overboard. And Jonah sinks down into the depths of the sea, into the darkness and despair of the abyss, and almost certain death. But just before he takes his last breath, a giant fish comes along and rescues him. And with its huge jaws open wide, Jonah enters into the very depths of the belly of the fish. The jaws close, the lights go out. And Jonah found himself in the belly of a fish. Now, this wasn't like Pinocchio. He didn't light a campfire so he could see inside the fish. He couldn't see his own hand in front of his face. Disoriented, exhausted, isolated, suffering, all alone, 3 days and three nights, Jonah has become the knot inside the stomach of the fish. He's reached the end of his rope, and he has nowhere else to go but up. And that's exactly where he goes. Rather than cry out in a prayer of lament and anguish to God, Jonah confounds expectations again. He offers up a prayer of praise and thanksgiving. "In my distress, I cried out to Yahweh, and he answered me. From the depths of Sheol, the grave, the dark underworld of death, I called for help, and you heard my cry." With what little breath he had left, Jonah offered it in thankfulness, in gratitude. He recounts his whole ordeal as he's praying this prayer until he finally reaches the climax that he recognizes that it was God who reached out a hand to save, literally reached out a fish to save. And it changes his life. He begins to recognize the futility of clinging on to any illusion of control he may have had over his life. And that clinging on had limited him and his ability to be able to receive that presence, that light, that love that God is eternally giving, not only to Jonah, but to each of us. Jonah realizes he has a new lease on life and decides to not just offer up a song of praise, but to offer up his whole life as a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to the one who's given him life. Truly, as Jonah says at the end of the prayer, deliverance, salvation is from God. Truly, Jonah was found in the belly of a fish. It's a lovely story, albeit slightly strange. And it would be beautiful if it just ended right there, or if it even ended in chapter 3, when Jonah does respond to the call, and he does go to Nineveh, and he does share God's message with the people there, that they need to turn away from their selfishness and turn towards the selfless love that gives them life, and that they'd better do it in 40 days. And that the Ninevites do actually respond in faith. And that God actually does do a 180 away from judgment and wrath and towards grace and welcome. But the story doesn't end there. It goes on into chapter 4, our scripture reading for this morning. Hear the word of the Lord. Brooks.
Jonah was furious. He lost his temper. He yelled at God, God, I knew it. When I was back home, I knew this was not going to happen. That's why I ran off to Tarshish. I knew you were sheer grace and mercy, not easily angered, rich in love, and ready at the drop of a hat to turn your plans of punishment into a program of forgiveness. So God, if you won't kill them, kill me. I'm better off dead. God said, what do you have to be angry about? But Jonah just left. He went out of the city to the east and sat down on a sulk. He put together a makeshift shelter of leafy branches and sat there in the shade to see what would happen to the city. God arranged for a broad-leafed tree to spring up. It grew over Jonah to cool him off and get him out of his angry sulk. Jonah was pleased and enjoyed the shade. Life was looking up. But then God sent a worm. By the dawn of the next day, the worm had bored into the shade tree, and it withered away. The sun came up, and God sent a hot, blistering wind from the east. The sun beat down on Jonah's head, and he started to faint. He prayed to die. I'm better off dead. Then God said to Jonah, what right do you have to get angry about this shade tree? Jonah said, plenty of right. It's made me angry enough to die. God said, what's this? How is it that you can change your feelings from pleasure to anger overnight about a mere shade tree that you did nothing to get? You neither planted nor watered it. It grew up one night and died the next night. So why can't I likewise change what I feel about Nineveh from anger to pleasure, this big city of more than 120,000 childlike people who don't yet know right from wrong, to say nothing of all the innocent animals?
This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
And thanks be to you, Brooks. So Jonah finally shares the message God wanted him to share, albeit in his own words and without a lot of nuance or sensitivity. And the Ninevites respond the way God had hoped they would. They turn from the darkness of hate and death and towards the light of love and life. And Jonah's angry. Not just angry, the popular vernacular would be pissed off. He's furious. Why? Perhaps in part, it's understandable. Given the cultural context of the time of this story, an Israelite giving a message like this to the Ninevites was not unlike a Jewish believer giving a message to the Germans immediately following World War II. There's some reason to be angry. There's some reason to feel wounded, hurt by the turn of events. What the Ninevites and the Assyrians had done to the people of Israel and other nations like them. I wonder if looking back in Israel's history might help us better understand both Jonah's response and then God's response. The original divine calling to humanity, God calling out to Abraham and Sarah. Do you remember the words? I will make you a great nation. I will make you a great nation that will be a blessing to all other nations, all people. Not the greatest nation, but a great one. And Israel's struggle throughout their history, ongoing struggle, is in seeing themselves not as a great nation, but as the greatest nation. Feeling some sense of superiority over other nations and other people, which tends to arise from a deeper sense of feeling inferior to others and fearful of other people, which usually arises from an even deeper sense of forgetting their core identity, forgetting who they are and whose they are. Israel's struggle is really Jonah's struggle. And Jonah's struggle is really the human struggle. It is so easy for us to forget who we are and whose we are. It is so hard to remember, especially when we've been hurt, that at the core of who we are loved and we are love. It's challenging to embrace this light of love because it's unconditional, because it's limitless, because the brilliance and brightness and beauty of it sometimes is so far beyond our imagining and our experience that it can literally become unbearable for us. To imagine the light of a love that extends that far and goes that deep into who we are and into who we are as a community of people on this earth. It's challenging to embrace that kind of light, to bear that kind of love. And yet, perhaps when we are able to bear the light of that love and its weight, when we are able to embrace that love because it's within us and it never leaves us, no matter what external circumstances may happen, no matter what decisions we may make in our own lives, when we are able to bear the light of that love within ourselves, that can have an amazing and empowering effect on us as we become bearers of the light of that love to each other. And even to allow it to expand beyond us in ways that we can hardly even imagine. When we are bearers of this light and we're centered by that weight of it in the depths of our heart and souls, it's amazing how much we can then be a voice for the voiceless. We can cry out for justice for those who are living under the weight of injustice. We can stand up to powers that seek to marginalize and oppress people for any and every reason in our culture. And we can act and demonstrate this love, this light, in more powerful ways because we demonstrate it without demonizing those whom we are seeking to share it with. Could look at it another way. When our starting point in life is right and wrong, more often than not, we end up at us and them. But when our starting point is love, I am loved. I am love. More often than not, we are amazed to discover that that leads to you are loved. You are love. And that, in turn, can eventually lead to we are loved. We are love. Our story ends with a question, like a lot of the greatest stories in our scriptures. It's one of the great gifts of our tradition, is that so often the most powerful stories are left unfinished. And that can be frustrating, but it can also be empowering. Because I wonder if those stories are left unfinished because it's actually an invitation for us to finish them ourselves in the way we live our lives. You may be wondering, what did Jonah learn from all of this? How did Jonah respond to that great question from God? And to find some insight in response to those questions, I went to a great and complex and profound source of wisdom in our day and age, VeggieTales. You remember those children's videos from not so long ago, taking Bible stories and creatively and humorously presenting them to children and really to adults too. Their only feature-length presentation that actually showed in theaters was the story of Jonah. And at the climax of that story, if you've seen VeggieTales or any other animated cartoon that is geared towards children, the climax is usually a song or a song and dance. And in this case, that holds true. But the song is not what the hearers of the story are necessarily expecting. The storyteller stands up, and to the children and their parents to whom he's telling the story and to the audience, sings a song. Jonah was a prophet, but he really never got it. And then the song and dance ensues. And by the end of it, they're singing this in this great jazzy chorus. And then the song ends. And the storyteller closes up his book and says, "The end," and turns around and walks away. The children and their parents are going, "What? How can you leave us hanging like that? What did Jonah learn from the experience? How did Jonah respond?" The storyteller stops, turns around, comes back, and says this. Maybe the question isn't, what did Jonah learn by the experience? But what did you learn from the experience? Maybe the question isn't, how did Jonah respond? Maybe the question is, how will you respond? How will we respond? Amen.